Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
And thanks for listening to On DOD this week. Glad you're with us. I'm Jared Serbu. We're going to cover several topics during the course of the hour today. Later on in the show, we'll talk with the Office of Naval Research about some technology demonstrations they're conducting, hoping to create systems that can automate the process of getting real-time imagery and other kinds of intelligence into the hands of frontline Marines, mostly using commercial smartphones. And speaking of smartphones, we'll also get the latest from the Defense Information Systems Agency on their current thinking about the ongoing problem of securing mobile devices, namely how to do that two-factor user authentication, the same way DoD users do now with the common access cards they insert into their computers. But we begin the hour with a conversation with the director of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Dr. Arthi Prabhakar sat down with me for a few minutes as part of the process of gathering material for a recent series you might have heard on Federal News Radio. It's called A New Era in Federal Technology, still available on our website. This interview was taped a couple weeks ago, but we have not aired that full interview in full until today. We spend most of our time on budgetary resources for DARPA projects.
Well, first of all, we're certainly not immune to all the budget chaos that's going on. And so DARPA's budget has felt the impact of declining defense budgets. And we participated in the sequestration cuts, the furloughs, et cetera. And the uncertainty continues. Now, for what we do, because we're a projects agency, we are constantly looking at our priorities. Every year we're racking and stacking and figuring out where we need to make our investments, what's working, where we want to double down, what's not working, and we should get out and move on. That, of course, just, you know, with reducing budgets, we just have to draw the line in a different place. And the cuts have, I would say, they are not a, you know, it's not a bullet to the heart. Mm-hmm. Really, it's an erosion in our ability to continue to make the full scale of investments that we need to make.
In your framework earlier this year, you talked about sort of a speculative future of long-term declining investment in science and technology in the country. But this is what we're talking about here is different. This is a sudden one-year decrease. So, I mean, do projects just fall off? Do you do things more slowly?
The specific impact from the sequestration cuts last year, in some cases we ended programs earlier than we normally would have, terminated contracts that were ongoing because we felt that was the place that it would do the least damage. In other cases, we delayed new programs that we were starting. We had, you know, contracts that were in the process of being awarded that we simply slowed down. So we were able to absorb those cuts in a variety of different ways. Again, you know, 1 year, it's pain, but it's something we can absorb. It's just this continuing gradual erosion that becomes the longer term issue.
Mm-hmm. So DARPA, I mean, is known for projects that are potentially high payoff, but also sometimes high risk. In this kind of environment, is there a temptation inside the agency to be somewhat more risk averse and focus on things that are definitely going to have a payoff?
Yeah, you're on a really core point for DARPA. We exist to deliver breakthrough technologies for national security. So what drives our investment is the high payoff part of that equation. And we, you know, I always say to my folks at DARPA, if you come across a high payoff opportunity that involves no risk, let's for sure do that. But usually when you want to reach for dramatic changes in capability, it does involve taking on risk. And we were explicitly started in 1958 to be the place that had the room to go do that. And so as a core DARPA value, we work very hard to make sure that those budget pressures do not push us away, you know, make us shy about taking risk. We stay clearly focused on reaching for high impact and being willing to take the risk that goes with that. So I'll say we're very fortunate that we get the support we need to do that, because we have delivered on that premise for 55 years, and we think it's important to just continue to stay focused on that.
Say a little bit more, if you would, about how you think about commercial technology. You know, people think about DARPA as a place where big bang things that no one's ever seen are invented. We don't think of you taking things off the shelf and using them or repurposing them. How do you think about COTS stuff?
DARPA? I think of what we care about in terms of technology for national security as being very having a complex set of interwoven relationships with commercial technology. And historically, what we often see is investments that DOD or specifically DARPA has made in the past. I came out of the microelectronics world, so that's an area where I saw over decades defense investments that were driven by the need for smaller, more capable electronic functions. That drove a lot of the research in places like universities and all kinds of companies. Because of the vast commercial opportunities that the private sector saw as those technologies started emerging, that private investment really drove, RF semiconductor technology and the huge explosion in VLSI and new microprocessor architectures and MEMS technology. All of those had deep roots back in government research funding, but that huge private investment is what made them commercially viable technologies. Now, that commercial capability is there. It's this juggernaut that is driven by huge economic forces. Now it's a huge opportunity for DOD, again, to take advantage of that. How do we surf on top of that and take all that power but then repurpose it so that we get all of that capability and the ability to move fast and be agile as technology keeps changing. So to go from sort of theoretical to specific, one of our programs is called ADAPT, and it takes the Snapdragon processor that Qualcomm puts into high-end smartphones, and essentially that program recognized that the same things that go in your smartphone are the same things we need to build a huge number of the sensor networks or communication systems that we need in DOD. You need high-speed processing, you need a bunch of sensors, you need to know what your orientation is, you need to know what your global position is, you need to be able to communicate. Well, why don't we leverage all of that capability? So the ADAPT program has created a set of nodes that are built on this commercial technology but are a great backbone so that when you want to build a new kind of sensor network, something we need to do for national security all the time, you can go start with that huge amount of capability and very quickly, design at the systems level something that solves the DOD problem we're after.
Yeah, and so, obviously that gets to the fundamental issues of cost and schedule, and that's another one of the things you talk about in your framework is innovating around the area of changing the cost equation. Talk to me a little bit about that. What does that mean? How do you innovate in the area of cost?
Yeah, and I think for the high-tech national security community, this whole theme is something that is new, and I don't think any of us are very good at it, and it's a challenge that I really want to put out to all of us at DARPA and the community that we work with, simply because I think we are on a path where we're going to build PowerPoint in the future instead of building real systems if we don't use innovation to change cost. So how does that actually, how could that really happen? We have some examples in our portfolio, and ADAPT is one of, building on top of this commercial juggernaut of technology. A very different example might be in very fundamental ways rethinking the deep reasons for cost in an area like space, one of the most costly the most costly domain that we try to operate in. Now, if you're really going to break the back of the cost situation in space, there's not going to be one silver bullet solution. You have to fundamentally rethink launch. You have to fundamentally rethink satellite economics, and we have programs that are doing all those pieces, but together that whole portfolio, I think if we're successful, we'll start building this future where launch is flexible and available on 24-hour call-up from any runway around the world, and at a price point where for, you know, a million or a few million dollars, you can boost a reasonable payload to LEO, or the ability to build satellites for GEO that where you can do servicing and reuse and assembly on orbit, which really starts changing the cost over the life cycle of these kinds of systems. So sometimes it's going to be leveraging commercial technology. Sometimes it's going to be radical new architectures for whole domains. But those are, I think we're going to have to really push our creativity to drive cost.
And along those lines, I mean, do you see opportunities for technology to fundamentally change the acquisition process itself, short circuit the testing process, whatever? I mean, are there opportunities there?
I think that there are opportunities to do that. And often the way we do that is, you know, a lot of DARPA's success historically has simply been showing what's possible. So we have some examples of work that we're doing where the objective is simply to show that systems can be built and, designed, built, created, tested on a very, very short time schedule. Sometimes it's largely about the business practices that we use. We have a long-range anti-ship missile program that started by when we heard from PAC Fleet a number of years ago, about 5 years ago, about an operational issue that they were concerned about, looking for a much more effective long-range anti-ship missile capability. We went out and took known technologies, combined them, a lot of hard systems engineering to combine them into a very effective new missile capability. We're just in the middle right now of some flight tests that are going extremely well, and we want to get that going with the Navy so that they can now turn it into an operational capability. Soup to nuts, that will have been a very short time from knowing that there was a problem to having an initial operational capability because of smart technology, but also the business processes to make that happen.
Last thing, because we're almost out of time. Getting back to the importance of innovation coming out of industry, with funding constraints that you're in right now, does it change the way you need to interact with, communicate with those industrial partners, communicate with them specifically about what they're doing with their IRAD money, where they're directing their research?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I really want to underscore that DARPA is a projects agency. Our work gets done because of our ability to work not just with the defense industry, but with companies of all sizes, commercial companies, defense companies, also universities, also not-for-profit labs, DOD labs, all of our partners across science and technology in the government. And I don't think, to me, the environment we're in doesn't really change something that has been fundamental at DARPA for decades, which is a recognition that we can't do our job by just sitting in our offices and waiting for whoever knows about DARPA to come knock on our door. And so I fully expect my program managers to be out on the road going and finding people who don't know we exist or don't know that they should be working on national security challenges and engaging them. That might be new fields of academic research. It might be companies that are pursuing a commercial path but have technology that could be really important to us, as well as the traditional defense contractor community. So, that to me is not a change. It's a constant effort on our part to make sure that we get out and engage with the broadest possible rich technology community.
That's Dr. Aarthi Prabhakar, the director of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. She sat down with me during a DOD conference organized by the new online publication Defense One late last month. We want to thank them for lending us a mostly quiet room for a few minutes there. We take our first break here, and when we come back, we'll talk to the Office of Naval Research about their work to automate the intelligence dissemination process for lower echelon Marine forces. This is On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servia. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com, I'm Jared Servu. This is On DOD. Turning from DARPA to the Marine Corps in our next segment. The Marines just wrapped up a technology demonstration in Hawaii last month. The main objective was to try and push forward some new systems that can automatically sift through the massive volumes of data that are now being collected by unmanned aerial vehicles and other military sensors and get it into the hands of frontline Marines right away via commercial smartphones, with no analysts having to act as middlemen in between and potentially slowing down that process. The demonstration is an annual event called Agile Bloodhound. The Marines partnered with the Office of Naval Research and other organizations to pull it off. John Moniz is the Agile Bloodhound Program Manager at ONR. He talked with me by phone from his office in Arlington, Virginia.
Agile Bloodhound is really emphasizing the integration of various C4 and ISR technologies so we can deliver relevant information content quickly to lower echelon operators. And at the same time, we want to prevent the information overload problem by providing them information they're not really interested in or don't really need at the time. And so we use the term dissemination of content really as a shorthand for describing what we're trying to do. Again, giving them the information they need when they need it, but giving them nothing else.
And so when you say lower echelon, how far down the chain are we talking about?
Well, we're talking, when we say that in the Marine Corps context, which was the emphasis for this evolution of Agile Bloodhound, we're talking company and below. So company, platoon, squad, fire team. And a company, just for your information, is about around 180 Marines.
If I'm understanding you right, you know, up at the higher echelons, there's plenty of information and plenty of people to deal with it. Down at those lower levels, you have people on the ground operating. They don't necessarily have all the information they need, but you can't throw everything at them because they don't have the capacity or the time to sift through it all. Is that a fair way of saying it?
That's valid. And there's another big difference is the availability of communications to support the movement of information. So at a higher echelon, they typically will be very well connected, closer to what you might expect in the commercial internet, in the business world. When you start getting a company below, we're doing everything wireless, and it's not with the type of robust infrastructure we have in the cellular phone system. So the information flow is more intermittent, and it's much lower data rates than even a commercial user expects to get over on his smartphone.
Can you give us a little bit of a sense of the types of information that you're trying to integrate and push forward?
The first thing we're trying to do is push forward autonomously generated intelligence reports that are relevant to the mission and the geographical location of each of the units. And so really what it is distilled intel, you know, video, other human intelligence, and other types of intelligence that we routinely collected. And most of the time at higher echelons, we actually, as you were alluding to, have intel analysts that are able to work through all this information and produce a product within hours or days. Very good product, but not that timely. What we're trying to do is automate some of the processes at the lower echelons so that we are able to deliver a reasonable quality product in a very short amount of time.
At that lower echelon, what does the Marine unit actually see? What does that product look like? Or is there not one thing?
We're working a lot, and this is in concert with what the larger Marine Corps is doing, is working with a smartphone-type device that has a display and can, you know, typically it's a geographical type display with icons telling them, you know, where other units are. And what we add to that is sources of information as they're flowing out. It can be things like alerts as events unfold and, you know, we learn more or the adversary does something unexpected or reports such as that can quickly flow down to the these lower echelon warfighters.
Getting back to your mention of smartphones and tablets, are these essentially unmodified off-the-shelf devices?
We worked with two different types. The Marine Corps has Marine Corps Acquisition has a program where they are developing secure smartphones and tablets, and we work with those as well as commercial off-the-shelf ones as platforms. The big difference that we have is that we need to use tactical communications and not the cellular system to move the information around because of security and vulnerability reasons.
Yeah, how much of a leap is it to modify those devices so they can operate over those tactical networks?
We actually use a separate tactical radio to make it easy for the demonstration purposes. Actually integrating a tactical radio would be quite a feat and probably destroy the cost benefits. So we in the larger Marine Corps and Navy are looking at other ways of doing this. The first thing we're doing right now is just actually connecting it to a tactical radio. In the future, we'll be looking at ways that we can economically modify the smartphone to allow us to do this. And with the current technologies, it's just not economically feasible to do it. So this would be something we're looking toward further in the future.
Given the tactical radio systems that exist right now, do Marines on the battlefield have the communications capabilities and the bandwidth, I guess, to do what you're trying to do through this demonstration, or does that need some upgrading as well?
Two answers to that question. First, everything we develop, we develop for the low bandwidth, intermittent communications environment. But at the same time, we like to demonstrate more enhanced capabilities as the Marine Corps fields more and more high throughput data radios, and those are slowly being fielded as we speak.
Is there a point somewhere down the road where you can imagine where you can secure transmission sufficiently over commercial, cellular networks or satellite networks so that you don't have to figure out a way to integrate those tactical radios? Is that a possibility?
We're already working on those types of capabilities, but a bigger problem with the cellular system is that the Marine Corps is not going to be able to bring in the infrastructure with the towers and the fiber connections between the towers to give us a viable extended cell phone network in the battle space. It's just not practical.
Right.
So we have to rely on other technologies to try to deliver information, be it networks of tactical radios or, in some cases, just delivering higher capacity radios that allow us to push more information.
Based on the demonstrations that you just did, how promising and how mature do these capabilities look right now? How quickly might they be deployed?
Some of the more mature ones, our acquisition stakeholders are talking about maybe picking that up within a couple of years. Some of the other ones are less mature, and they're going to take, it could be 6 or so years before they're mature enough for them to actually pick up. We were getting, quite good feedback, to get back to the earlier part of your question, about the usability of this, and we were getting the critical comments that we need to refine our investments as we move forward to make them both more useful for the operator and at the same time being something that can fit more easily into the acquisition programs.
And what exactly do you imagine pushing out to the battlefield? I mean, is it going to be satellite and ISR imagery, or, written intelligence reports, all the above?
That is an ongoing area of research, and the first thing we're trying to do is tailor the product to both the need of the user and the capacity of the network. And so, for an example, a relevant video feed has recently become available. We could send the whole video clip, depending on the condition of the network, but the user's need may be embodied in for example, a screenshot of that video or an automated system that can analyze the object in that video and just simply send down a quick message depending on the conditions and the capacity of the network. For example, tank spotted, this direction at this distance. So we're looking at all those types of things to not only improve the capacity of the network, but improve the quality of the information the user receives. The preliminary planning for next year for Agile Bloodhound 2014 to take place again in the fall is we are looking at adding some cyber capabilities and also some logistics to augment the capabilities we've already shown with the combination of the C2 and the ISR areas.
That's John Moniz from the Office of Naval Research. He's their program manager for the Agile Bloodhound technology demonstration they helped coordinate with the Marine Corps last month. Time for another break, and we will stick with the theme of mobile devices in DoD for the balance of the show, starting with a look at how the Defense Information Systems Agency is trying to tackle the problem of mobile authentication on commercial smartphones. This is on DoD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. We are back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This is On DoD. Thanks for listening. I'm Jared Serbu. We'll stick with the topic of mobile communications for the second half of our show because, of course, the Pentagon is not just interested in using smartphones on the battlefield, as we heard in our last segment. It would also very much like to get the latest mobile technology into the hands of its employees for day-to-day business functions. Security is the main impediment to that. The DoD thinks it's made a lot of progress on that front. The Defense Information Systems Agency, who's leading the department's enterprise push for mobile devices, thinks it now has a way to give security approvals for apps and for mobile infrastructure and for devices in a way that finally lets that happen before the technology's obsolete. One of the biggest roadblocks still, though, is finding a way to integrate those commercial mobile devices with the public key infrastructure DoD already uses to authenticate users on military networks. On regular desktops and laptops, folks handle that two-factor authentication piece by putting their ID cards, the common access cards, as they're commonly called, CAC cards, into some kind of reader. That provides a lot more security than a username and password, obviously, but DoD has not figured out how to make that kind of technology work in a cost-effective way for tablets and smartphones. In the next couple segments, we're going to hear about a couple of the ideas DoD is exploring to make PKI work on mobile devices. The next couple pieces of audio you'll hear are from a recent panel discussion. This was from a conference on mobility that the AFSEA chapter here in D.C. sponsored on mobile devices in the military. The first voice you'll hear is Devin O'Brien. He is the lead engineer for public key infrastructure at DISA, the Defense Information Systems Agency.
Being the owners and maintainers of a public key infrastructure, we're very much focused on the protection of private keys. And in mobile devices, it's sort of the wild, wild west right now. In terms of protecting these keys on the device. We have good, robust ways of doing this in servers and, to some degree, workstations. We're looking to extend that into mobile devices, but the only problem is there's not a handy spot to put your CAC on a mobile device, and it's sort of clunky and clumsy. And to date, the solutions have been Bluetooth or corded smart card readers that are very, very difficult to use. Generals and SESs just, you know, they're they're not very in favor, separate power devices anyway. So the user experience is awful. Because we're such a niche market, the cost per device is awful. So that's sort of what prompted the look for alternate credentials. So one of the areas that we looked in is that at least a couple years ago, the vast majority of mobile devices have microSD slots. And so microSD is a form factor that we can actually get HSMs that are sitting in all of your CACs or SIPR tokens or all of the credentials that we hardware credentials that we use, and we've reached out to vendors to put those chips into a microSD form factor and get them through the FIPS approval process. Some of the work in this area is, as I mentioned, pushing the vendors to implement this technology in their chips, but there still remains the challenge of getting these chips usable on the mobile device. So from there, we are pushing for a standardized interface so that applications don't have to code to custom interfaces for a very much stovepipe solution in this environment as it is today. And one of the primary benefits of this as well is that it's a secondary credential. There are certain benefits to having your CAC that's used for physical entrance to facilities, for logical access to computer systems, and a second credential that you use for mobile devices. And so one of the other approaches is actually combining them. And so this is kind of an introduction to why we're looking at this form factor. And later on, I guess we can discuss what some of the challenges we are in this space, both from the DoD perspective and what we need vendors to solve problems, because we can't necessarily fix everything in this space.
That's Devin O'Brien. He's the lead engineer for public key infrastructure at DISA, the Defense Information Systems Agency. Again, speaking on a panel about how DoD is tackling the challenge of multi-factor authentication on mobile devices. That micro SD solution is just one of many ideas the department's kicking around. We won't have time to cover all of them here, but another one is just using the SIM cards that are already installed on most phones. That's according to Greg Yost, the chief mobility engineer at DISA.
Basically, a little over 8 months ago, AT&T in Gemalto came to me because they started the effort based on the request of the Marines for their effort for their THC2, you know, trusted handheld. And they've actually developed a UICC capability for securing the private key as well as the application to access the key and the interface for the API for the applications to talk to it and everything else. Because what you have to understand, Gemalto is one of the primary card vendors for us for our CAT cards. So they're very highly familiar with this area. And for those who don't know, Gemalto is one of the premier providers of SIM cards around the world. Your carrier, you've probably got a 60% chance that the SIM card in your phone is a Gemalto card. So what happened was is the Gemalto was leveraging the capability for payments, which is called ISIS. The carriers have all gotten with Gemalto, and they're developing the ISIS API and the ISIS application where you can use your mobile phone like you can in Japan, walk up to a Coke machine, hold your phone up to a Coke machine, and make a payment with your, you know, with your SIM card through the NFC to the Coke machine. So Gemalto took it one step further and says, why can't we do this for a government CAC? Because it's the same basic function. You got a secure element to store the key. You've got a private API and everything. It's not private. They have their own API that they're pushing to become a standard. But the point is they've actually all – we've been through two rounds of this already with them. They've already got a prototype working, and I'm providing guidance to them on directions of where we want to take this and how we're going to use it in the government and what we got to go through for approvals and everything else, because it has to get through NSA certification and a few other things. But the point I'm driving at, they've already actually demonstrated it where they've actually put the – generated the actual private key, went through all the processes of key generation and everything else, and actually did basically put a CAC on a SIM card. The biggest problem we have right now is it doesn't work for Apple. So the point I'm driving, that's what they're developing it for Android right now, and we're looking at Windows and mobile, Windows and BlackBerry down the line. Okay, so that's another approach we're looking at to move forward with it. The only problem is, of all the solutions that we're working on, not one of them works for Apple. So we're still talking with Apple on this whole process because Apple won't open up their API for the UICC. So we're still one of them. So yet everybody in DOD wants an Apple device. Not everybody, but, you know, a lot of folks. But the point I'm driving at is, you know, we are working towards solutions, but unfortunately the solutions don't work for everything. So we're always going to have to be looking at a band of solutions.
That's Greg Yost, the Chief Mobility Engineer at the Defense Information Systems Agency, talking about one of the ideas DOD's cooking up for solving the challenge of user authentication on tablets and smartphones, maybe one of the hardest problems the military's facing when it comes to integrating those commercial mobile devices into the day-to-day business of the department. When we come back from our final break, we will get a bigger picture view on DOD's progress toward that commercial mobile device goal. This is On DOD on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm Jared Servio. Back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbe. Just a few minutes left in our show this week, and we're staying with mobile technology. In our last segment, we heard from officials at the Defense Information Systems Agency about some of the methods they're looking at to solve the tough problem of multi-factor user authentication on mobile devices. We'll step back now and get a bigger picture view of where DISA is headed with mobility. This is Dr. Jennifer Carter, the Component Acquisition Executive at DISA, talking at a November FCEA conference about the agency's goal to build an end-to-end mobility infrastructure for DOD.
The intent is to bring the capabilities, not have mobility as an end item itself, and, you know, the point of you know, having mobile capabilities. The point is to bring the capabilities in systems that we offer today and that we are developing using mobile devices as an end item. And an example of this would be things like unified capabilities. DISA continues to expand what our enterprise service offerings are. As was mentioned in the opening, it's not just about email and calendar, voice over IP, video, chat, presence. There's an integrated suite of these tools. So as we work to mature those, the idea is to have those capabilities also available on a mobile end item device. But it's not just about the enterprise services that we offer. It's also about across DOD things like logistics, things like office capabilities. and be able to use your mobile device for a broad range of those capabilities. So as we move forward, the intent is to develop that infrastructure so that everybody can leverage it. You don't want to develop that 4 or 5 times across DoD. That's the tedious part, how you manage an application store, how you set up the security, how you provide that access globally, how you manage do the telephony management. Those are the tedious pieces of setting up an infrastructure that you benefit by working those from a central approach. And then putting the efforts across DoD from a specialized perspective into where it really matters for your unique mission, and that's in the application space and in the software development piece, and making your capabilities mobilely available. So one of the things I wanted to talk about is just the vision for how we move forward with this beyond just the infrastructure piece. So we're working on that today. But if you extend beyond just the mobile infrastructure and how people use their devices today, because the capabilities have been limited, it hasn't allowed us to get rid of the desktop phones or the desktop computers. And we really need to evolve into a place where that's where we're getting to, or the logistics devices, specialized logistics devices. Smartphones and tablets can provide a broad range of capabilities that will allow the replacement of more standard infrastructure so that the capabilities don't have to be geographically tied to your office or your location. And that's really important because there's a very big investment in the infrastructure that in these times of difficult budget environments, we really need to move forward to be able to leverage the promise of that business case of being able to reduce the costs on that infrastructure. So one of the things we're really focusing on is making sure that those types of capabilities are available on the devices so that we can get to the heart of where the business case is for this, but then also to expand capabilities into capabilities that were never available via mobile device before. And that's moving into the realm that'll allow people to really branch out the support for the warfighter. Now, having a mobile application store really enhances that because you can develop applications fairly quickly. We have an application vetting process that is very rapid, and then we can drop those applications in the application store. So that's the next big ticket area of where the capability really needs to move forward is in the application arena. And we're going to have the application store up and running for DoD in the second quarter of fiscal year 14. So hopefully by early in the next calendar year. It can extend beyond where we are on standard DoD, the Intel, the business side, enterprise resource planning applications, looking at business information, looking at logistics information, medical information. So there's a broad range of application. In fact, the medical community already uses mobile devices, and we've been working to coordinate with the medical community in providing network capabilities that allow them to use mobile devices from a broader perspective. We've really made a lot of progress. So we've been in the pilot mode with many partners for the last part of the last year, and now we're moving into initial operating capability. And so from the FY13 accomplishments perspective, we've stood up the mobile device management and mobile application store. We've got the contract in place. It isn't quite finished, but we expect that to be in place and completed, as I mentioned, by the early beginning of the next calendar year. We have 2,000 plus unclassified devices in limited operational capability. And what that means is that until we get the mobile device management and application store where we can do more remote management, which takes away some of the tedious manual efforts that we've had in the pilot, we've limited the scope of that. But we have many partners that have participated in that, and we've joined with activities and planned activities that other pilots across the services. And so we've got 2,000-plus users, and that number continues to grow. So as we move into IOC early in the beginning of the next calendar year, we're going to expand greatly that number, and we're going to expand capacity as required, and we can expand the capacity by the end of 14 all the way up to 100,000 users. And that's referencing the smartphone tablet component of our mobile support. And we, as I mentioned earlier, we already have a very large number of users on the BlackBerry and SmePet side. So in addition to the unclassified device, and you can see we've got a lot of applications already in processing for that, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. The other component of it is the classified device, and we've been in the pilot mode for that, and that's a joint effort with the National Security Agency. And we've got 200-plus users participating in that pilot, and that also is targeted for IOC early in the next calendar year. And that device that's provided improved voice quality over devices in the past, and it's got interoperability with legacy voice, which has been a great feature, and also provides access for the Defense Enterprise email. So we're continuing to work at the next generation for the releases of the classified mobility as well.
That's Dr. Jennifer Carter, the Component Acquisition Executive at the Defense Information Systems Agency, talking about DISA's push to build an enterprise mobility capability for the entire Defense Department. Earlier in the program, we heard from other DISA officials about their efforts to solve the tough problem of multi-factor user authentication with CAT cards on mobile devices. We also heard from the Office of Naval Research about their efforts to get intelligence into the hands of Marines on mobile devices, and from Dr. Arthi Prabhakar, the director of the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, about her agency's mission and how it's dealing with sequestration. If you missed any of the show, we'll post it all at federalnewsradio.com/ondod, as always. That's going to do it for this week's program. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Jared Serbia. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.